Welcome to the Wolfner Talking Book in Braille Library Podcast. Enhance your patron experience as you join us for the latest information, educational resources, and engaging interviews with the people working behind the scenes to ensure all Missourians may read. We are so glad you've joined us.
This is Vanessa Lingle with the Wolfner Talking Book in Braille Library, and I'm here today to talk about mountain men. And so I'm with Kevin Smith, but Kevin, I'm going to let you, will you introduce yourself to us? Tell us a little bit about you and what you do in Missouri.
Yes. Hello. My name is Kevin Smith. I'm a park and historic site specialist for Missouri State Parks. I've been in this role, I've been working for the Department of Natural Resources for about 16 years. And I work in the central office here in Jefferson City, so I'm not at any one location. I help out the parks by helping write and research topics for presentations. And lately, I've been giving a lot of presentations.
So we're going to keep it simple. When we met, we were talking about Missouri mountain men, which I didn't even know we had. What is a mountain man?
Okay. A mountain man is an explorer who lives in the wilderness and primarily makes a living off of hunting and fur trapping. Mountain men were common in the Rocky Mountain region just after the Lewis and Clark expedition of 1804 during the North American fur trade. They were instrumental in opening the country to the rest of the population by getting out there, pretty much scouting out what was out there first. They primarily harvested beaver pelts, and they sent them back to the east. During that time, the fur trade was really, really business. Some mountain men even served as guides for the military during the westward expansion.
I was thinking this might be an interesting podcast for No Shave November. Have you heard of No Shave November?
I have heard of No Shave November, yes.
It's a little bit silly, but I thought, gosh, this would be fun if we could squeak in this Mountain Man podcast right before No Shave November. And I notice you have a little bit of facial hair. Like, that's kind of exciting.
Yes, absolutely. I could probably get away with it for No Shave November, and I can definitely add more information about the appearance of the mountain man and how they were kind of rugged looking individuals and living off the clothing was like buckskin or furs or just stuff that they raccoon skin hats, that type of thing.
Yeah,
we'll get more into that.
Let's start there. So Kevin, can you tell me a little bit about the appearance of a mountain man, stereotypes or reality?
Okay. Yes, most of the mountain men, they were kind of rugged type of individuals. You initially had fur trappers that were French and German that were, you know, making their way up into the area. Pretty much the undesirables of society, if you will, they were kind of out in the wild living on their own, but they were a tight-knit community and shared a lot of information. A lot of times these guys were burly looking guys. You know, probably hadn't shaven in a while, definitely had not had a good shower in a while. You know, they probably had a very, very interesting and intimidating appearance, pretty much mixing in with the appearance of the indigenous peoples and tribes that they were running into.
Fantastic. So you had introduced me to James Beckworth. So why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about him, where he's from, and what you're learning in your research?
Absolutely. James Beckworth is a really, really interesting individual. With St. Louis being the edge of the civilization going west, it was also the same going east. So many of the fur trappers and mountain men that I spoke of earlier and major fur companies were operating out of the St. Louis area. And at the time, they shipped supplies up and down the Missouri River from St. Louis. Jim's story is incredibly interesting because Missouri was his home, the location that he used as his launch port for many of his adventures. He was born a slave, which was a product of a mixed relationship, his father being Jennings Beckwith. And Jennings Beckwith owned James's mother, or Jim's mother. when Jim was about 9 years old. He was from Virginia. When he was about 9 years old, his father moved him and his family to the Confluence Point area of St. Charles, where the Missouri River and the Mississippi Rivers pretty much meet. Jim's father treated Jim and his siblings as his own children, which was a bit odd for those times, but I guess he was forward thinking. But regardless of the social climate of what it was at the time, his father sent him to school in St. Louis. Then in 1824, his father went to the courthouse for the first of as many as three times to manumit or emancipate his son. And from this point on, Jim was a free man. He served as a deckhand on a steamship. He served as a guide for fur trapping expeditions. He was recruited by Richard Gentry of Columbia, Missouri, and served as one of the 600 men that was recruited or hired for their expertise during the Seminole War to help fight on what was going on down there. He was present during the Missouri Volunteers Charge at the Battle of Okeechobee. He went west and lived with a Crow tribe and then became a war chief among the Crow Nation, which was really interesting. He managed a hotel and a trading post in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He discovered a low-level pass in the Sierra Nevada Mountains, helping settlers reach the gold fields in California. He was a scout and guide for the Army in Colorado. And he ended up passing away in October of 1866, living amongst the Crow, and was giving an honorary Crow warrior chief a burial. And what made Jim so able to blend in so much was not only he was kind of able to blend in both worlds, if you will. He was educated, but then also he lived amongst the Crow tribe. So he learned their language and was able to, you know, in so many ways, manipulate the system and play in both worlds. Today, Jim has a mountain peak named after him. There's a mountain pass named after him and a town that all bear his name. And he was honored with his own stamp by the U.S. Postal Service for his contributions to this country. Many of Jim's peers and a lot of authors that have written about him consider him to be called the quote unquote gaudy liar, because in most of his stories, he always seems to make himself the hero or the person that comes along and saves the day. But much of Jim's life has been verified by documents and others that were there or mentioned him by name as being present. The one thing that I do find interesting about Jim was that he was literate. He was a free Black man, and he was documented to be involved and witnessed or participated in many of the events that shaped this country. I believe that his life story is a reminder of the diverse narratives and multifaceted aspects that make up American history. That's why this story is very important.
Yeah. I mean, oral storytelling, whether they're embellished or not, it is super important to history. And I love that he was a storyteller. I mean, storytellers are where we get a lot of our early history from.
Yes, it's really, really interesting because there was only a few other books out about it during that time, depicted as a Black country. There were three books written by Frederick Douglass, one in 1852, 1854, and 1856, but that was primarily about slavery. And then there was Uncle Tom's Cabin, which again was about slavery. Jim's autobiography was anything but that. He was literally everywhere and did a lot of amazing things.
Do you have any stories, any of Jim's stories that you could share? I mean, anything come to mind when you think about the research you've done?
Let's see. The one story that I can think of, well, how he became a war chief. He was out participating as part of a hunting party, and I want to say it was the Colorado area. I guess there's like an area called Natural Monuments, but the area still exists. But he was out there leading a war party, and they were outnumbered by a bunch of other warriors from another tribe, and they encountered each other, and Jim's group was, you know, thinking, hey, we really can't take on this number of people, you know, this is suicide. And Jim pretty much just ripped his shirt off and pulled out his knives and said, hey, I'll show you how to fight, and yelled and screamed it out, which got all of the people that were with him pretty much charged, and they went towards the enemy, and they ended up winning the battle or the confrontation with a lot of the opposing warriors running off. But from that point on, Jim adopted a number of nicknames. One of them was Bloody Arm. One of them was Medicine Calf, Bull's Robe. I mean, he had all sorts of different names for all the accomplishments that he had done. Enemy of Horses. I mean, yeah, he just had a slew of names. He was incredible. Oh, yeah. Most of those names were traditionally given based on feats that they had accomplished within their tribe's culture. So, yeah, he had as many as 8 to 10 different names.
That's amazing. And there still are cultures today. I know, like in the deaf culture, like to receive a name from your community, it's an honor. So the fact that he had like 8 to 10 names that other people had given him, it's amazing. Yes.
He was quite an amazing individual for sure.
Oh, so before I forget, the mountain pass that is named after him, what state are we talking about? I mean,
Beckwourth Pass. Mm-hmm. Beckwourth Pass is in California. In fact, I can let you know. It's in California. It goes between California and Nevada, and it slips right between the Sierra and the Nevada mountains. It's just north of Reno, Nevada. Okay.
Perfect. I mean, just in case anyone wants to visit or they're heading through that way. All right. Well, I was wondering a little bit about, I thought we might talk a little bit about accessibility with traveling and with trails. And I know you had mentioned, were you doing audio recordings for a trail last time we had chatted?
Yes. In Missouri State Parks, we have 93 state parks and historic sites, with a few in various processes. So there'll be more to come. We have 18 parks that have what are called beach chairs. Beach chairs are wheelchairs that float and help visitors with limited mobility access swimming areas that are not suitable for traditional wheelchairs. And we have 18 parks that have those. We have 4 parks that have track chairs, which are electronic off-road chairs, pretty much the Humvee of wheelchairs, if you will, with huge industrial tracks on the side that allow visitors with limited mobility the opportunity to explore areas of the park that are not suitable for traditional wheelchairs. So meaning like rocky, hilly, off-road trail type areas. So we have the ones that can go in water as well as some ones that can go on rugged terrain. We also are working on a project called the Missouri Virtual Heritage Tour, and we're really looking forward to the launch of this. In 2022, Missouri State Parks received a $500,000 grant to create a 360-degree virtual tour of 20 locations that are accessible from the comfort of your couch, pretty much. For example, at Thomas Hart Benton Virtual Home Tour, you can like literally walk into the bathroom and open the medicine cabinet and see the items that he's own medicine cabinet. And so we're proud of that project, and we're looking forward to the launch of all of the videos. We're in various stages of production of those. We have regularly, we hire sign language interpreters to attend a lot of our events to make a lot of our programming inclusive for individuals that may be hearing impaired. And we also have what's called a Braille Trail at Elephant Rock State Parks. So as you weave along the trails and go between huge rocks, there are interpretive stations with Braille text. There's carpet patches and hand mark stations and changes in pathways and terrain. Most of the 1 mile path is shaded, so there's many areas to stop and rest. And Elephant Rock State Park also has track chairs, which are available free of charge for visitors with limited mobility as well. So you do have a combination of a Braille trail and track chairs at this one location. So there's a little bit of something for everything at Missouri State Parks and Historic Sites.
I love it. And before we go, do you have a favorite state park here in Missouri?
My favorite state park, I would have to say, as far as camping goes, I would say it's probably Pomme de Terre. Pomme de Terre it's in a really, really quiet, nice, calm area. It's almost like a low key type Lake of the Ozarks. In the Lake of the Ozarks, you can kind of get swallowed up by a bunch of the boats, a lot of the waves, just a whole bunch of the party atmosphere that's going on. No strike against the Lake of the Ozarks, but I prefer the nice, calm environment. So, Pomme de Terre State Park is where I choose to go whenever we take our camper out. And, as far as just the historical aspect, I would have to say Arrow Rock State Park.
Amazing. All right. Well, Kevin, I want to thank you for joining us today. We've been with Kevin Smith, a historic specialist for Missouri State Parks, and we wish you all the best, and we thank you for all your work making our parks more accessible.
The following excerpt comes from The Life and Adventures of James P. Beckwith, Jim Beckwith's autobiography. Although this title is not available on Bard, it seemed fitting to share this excerpt with you to give but a small taste of the mountain man life. For those who are interested in reading The Life and Adventures of James P. Beckwith, this book is in the public domain and audiobook recordings are available on YouTube. The party that I started with consisted of 31 men, most of them skillful trappers. Captain Bridger was in our party, and commanded by Robert Campbell. We started for Powder River, a fork of the Yellowstone, and arriving there without accident, we soon busied in our occupation. A circumstance occurred in our encampment on this stream, trivial in itself, for trivial events sometimes determine the course of a man's life, but which led to unexpected results. I had set my 6 traps overnight, and on going to them the following morning, I found 4 beavers, but one of my traps was missing. I sought it in every direction, but without success, and on my return to camp, mentioned the mystery. Captain Bridger, as skillful a hunter as ever lived in the mountains, offered to renew the search with me, expressing confidence that the trap could be found. We searched diligently along the river and the bank for a considerable distance, but the trap was among the missing. The float pole also was gone, a pole 10 or 12 feet long and 4 inches thick. We at length gave it up as lost. The next morning, the whole party moved farther up the river. To shorten our route, Bridger and myself crossed the stream at the spot where I had set my missing trap. It was a buffalo crossing, and there was a good trail worn in the banks, so that we could easily cross with our horses. After passing and traveling on some 2 miles, I discovered what I supposed to be a badger, and we both made a rush for him. On closer inspection, however, it proved to be my beaver, with trap, chain, and float pole. It was apparent that some buffalo, in crossing the river, had become entangled in the chain, and, as we conceived, had carried the trap on his shoulder, with the beaver pendant on one side and the pole on the other. We inferred that he had in some way got his head under the chain between the trap and the pole, and in his endeavors to extricate himself had pushed his head through. The hump on his back would prevent it passing over his body, and away he would speed with his burden, probably urged forward by the 4 sharp teeth of the beaver, which would doubtless object to his sudden equestrian, or rather bovine, journey. We killed the beaver and took his skin, feeling much satisfaction at the solution of the mystery. When we arrived at camp, we asked our companions to guess how and where we had found the trap. They all gave various guesses, but failing to hit the truth, gave up the attempt. "Well, gentlemen," said I, "it was stolen." "Stolen? exclaimed a dozen voices at once. Yes, it was stolen by a buffalo. Oh, come now, said one of the party. What is the use of coming here and telling such a lie? I saw in a moment that he was angry and earnest, and I replied, If you deny that a buffalo stole my trap, you tell the lie. He rose and struck me a blow with his fist. It was my turn now, and the first pass I made brought my antagonist to the ground. On rising, he sprang for his gun. I assumed mine as quickly. The bystanders rushed between us, and seizing our weapons, compelled us to discontinue our strife, which would have infallibly resulted in the death of one. My opponent mounted his horse and left the camp. I never saw him afterward. I could have taken his expression in jest, for we were very free in our sallies upon one another. But in this particular instance, I saw his intention was to insult me, and I allowed my passion to overcome my reflection. My companions counseled me to leave camp for a few days until the ill feeling should have subsided. If you would like to know more about the Mountain Men and the roles they played in American history, then check out some of the following titles available on Bard. A Majority of Scoundrels, An Informal History of the Rocky Mountain Fur Company by Don Barry. DBC 13770. The Rocky Mountain Fur Company, in its brief life from 1822 to 1834, employed such mountain men and fur trappers as Jedediah Smith, Jim Bridger, Hugh Glass, James Beckworth, and others. The author draws on their notes, letters, journals, and contemporary accounts to paint a realistic picture of life during this era. A Life Wild and Perilous, Mountain Men and the Paths to the Pacific by Robert Utley. DBC 16879. This vivid and heroic chronicle about the exploration of the American West tells the story of a small but distinctive group of mountain men whose knowledge and experience of the Trans-Mississippi West extended the national consciousness to continental dimensions. Mountain Men and Fur Traders of the Far West by Leroy Hafen, DBC 20541. Brief biographies of legendary mountain men, the fur traders and trappers who penetrated the Rocky Mountains and explored the Far West in the first half of the 19th century. Includes Jedediah Smith, Peter Skeen Ogden, Kit Carson, William Sublette, James Bridger, Benjamin Bonneville, and Joseph Meek, among others. If you're looking for a more detailed look into the lives of specific mountain men, we also have the following titles available. Mountain Man, John Coulter, The Lewis and Clark Expedition and the Call of the American West by David Weston Marshall, DBC 19470. The History of John Coulter, who set out as a hunter and scout for 28 months with Lewis and Clark on the first U.S. expedition to traverse the North American continent. Jim Bridger by Cecil Alter, DBC 13670. A Biography of Jim Bridger, 1804 to 1881. Bridger was a mountain man, frontiersman, trapper, and guide in the Rocky Mountain region. A factual historical narrative of a major personality of the Old West. Crow Killer, The Saga of Liver-Eating Johnson by Raymond Thorpe and Robert Bunker. DBC 13830. One morning in 1847, Mountain Man Jeremiah Johnson returned to his Rocky Mountain trapper's cabin to find the remains of his Indian wife and her unborn child, who had been killed by Crow Indians. The discovery made Johnson vow vengeance on the entire Crow Nation. Jedediah Smith and the Opening of the West by Dale Lowell Morgan, DB 10060. Smith was one of the reckless breed of mountain men who dared to explore the Rocky Mountains and beyond. A modest, intelligent, and religious man, after 8 years of hunting and trading, he set out for the Santa Fe Trail. Kit Carson, A Portrait in Courage, by M. Morgan Estergreen, DB 18968. Biography of the wiry man who became a legend of the Old West. Based on unpublished notes and primary source materials, the biography includes interviews and letters from Carson's family and friends. The Saga of Hugh Glass, Pirate, Pawnee, and Mountain Man by John Myers Myers, DBC 01996. Relates the adventures of Hugh Glass, who was by turns a pirate, a captive of the Pawnee, and a mountain man who dragged himself 2,000 miles after being left to die in the wilderness. These titles and more are available for download from Bard, or by contacting a reader advisor at 800-392-2614 in-state. Out-of-state patrons may reach us at 573-571-8720. Thank you for listening to the Wolfner Talking Book and Braille Library Podcast. For further inquiries on this episode, or for library service needs, you may contact us toll-free in-state at 1-800-392-2614. Out-of-state callers may reach us at 573-751-8720. By email at wolfner@sos.mo.gov, or visit us online at www.sos.mo.gov/wolfner.